In the Civil Rights Act of 1968, America does move forward. And the bell of freedom rings out a little louder.
This is A Little Louder, a podcast for wonks, housers, and rabble-rousers, where we talk about fair housing, community development, and how we can use these issues to build people power and work toward equity and justice. I'm Michael Deepland. About 6 or 7 months ago, Texas Housers was working at a property called Cabo San Lucas and a nearby property called The Redford. Many of the tenants were experiencing poor conditions, evictions for a myriad of reasons. But in our time there working with tenants, working with legal aid, one thing we had trouble to track down was who is actually the owner of these properties. On Texas Housers blog, we actually just uploaded a new post from our research analyst, Sydney Beatty, who is on the podcast with us today. Welcome to the show, Sydney.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on.
Just to give our listeners a little bit about what you do for Housers, why don't you describe your work and your research?
Yeah, so I am a research analyst in the Austin office of Texas Housers, but I primarily work on statewide issues. A lot of my past work has revolved around the low-income housing tax credit program and the rules that are updated annually that govern that program. But I do a lot of kind of side work on the data science side and responding to either community or staff data requests and trying to dig into data that's relevant to housing issues, such as ownership.
This particular property, you know, has been a problem property for, I mean, we're going into almost a year at this point, but we've known about it since about July, August of 2023. So I just want to get up to date with the audience here. Let's talk about the blog and your findings. You know, what made you interested in taking the extra step of looking into the ownership of places like Cabo San Lucas and the Redford?
Yeah, so originally I'd actually had kind of a separate research project of my own at Texas Housers where I was trying to do in Texas, either at the city or state level, trying to collect ownership data, trying to collect data from appraisal districts and trying to kind of match that up with other data to try to get a better understanding of who owned property in Texas and what kinds of properties they owned. I was facing quite a few roadblocks in that project, which I get into in the blog a little bit, but you know, it was partially availability, partially my own data abilities. It's really difficult work to do. And while I was working on this project, the Cabo, San Lucas, and Redford issue came up. So the middle of last summer, we heard from our Houston folks that, you know, a bunch of evictions had been filed. They're working with tenants, but they need to know who owns the property because there's an owner on the evictions. They're confused about the owner that's on the evictions themselves. It doesn't seem to be the appropriate name. So they had me look into it. And in the course of looking into it, you know, I found plenty on the old owner who had gone through multiple foreclosures that year and was being sued. And the properties themselves, Cabo San Lucas, had been in the news for years prior to this point for poor conditions and really a lot of issues for tenants. So the old owner's name was on these evictions, and they'd kind of had hit a point where they were confused about who owned the property because they were having issues working with this owner. This was a week after the foreclosure sale where the ownership had changed for this property in particular. So we started looking into it and we could find enough information about the old owner's Appleswade because they had been in the news a lot, but we couldn't find anything on this new owner who is the person who was actually supposed to be doing these evictions, right? Like they need to be filed under the current owner. And we were dealing with a bunch of evictions that were filed under the old owner. So we need to figure out who that new owner was that would be evicting. And we started looking into it and we found, you know, the name of the LLC, Cabo United LLC. But that was really all we could find. We couldn't find anybody behind this LLC. We found a bridge loan company, which they do lending before you get permanent financing. So likely they won't be involved in this deal for a long time. But we couldn't find anything long-term permanent beneficial ownership for this property. Combining that with that prior work that I had done looking into ownership, kind of realized that this is definitely an issue in Texas that affects specifically the populations that we work with and that we should probably try to kind of connect these contexts together. So that's when I started digging a little bit more specifically into the Cabo issue and kind of how this ownership issue looks in Texas, not on a data level since that work was a little bit difficult for just me, but on a kind of a broader sense and looking at the issues and the research that's out there.
So this was a problem that you were already researching, of the sort of murky, obscure ownership when these companies utilize tactics like putting a property under an LLC. You were already kind of tracking this. So can you explain exactly what the problem is with this kind of ownership structure and how it can prevent tenants from receiving justice or keep these problem owners accountable?
Owning a property under an LLC itself is not really the problem behavior. I mean, that's a tool that exists for a reason. There are valid reasons to use it. The core issue is that we have bad actors, like we saw at Cabo San Lucas, where the owners take advantage of those rules around those certain types of corporations like LLCs in order to lower their risk involved in that investment, to distance themselves from that bad behavior so that they don't have to face the consequences, and ultimately prevent advocates from fully understanding the scope of the issue locally because of those data issues that I was talking about, where we kind of have to deal with this on a one-off basis because we don't necessarily have the ability to look at it as a systemic or, you know, regional or statewide problem with data. Because there's so many shell companies between the beneficial owner and the property itself, it just becomes incredibly difficult to understand who exactly is the problem here, who exactly is perpetuating these behaviors.
Can you detail what are these bad behaviors that you've seen and you've found in your research? What are some of the examples of the things that these companies do utilizing these shell companies and other ways to obscure who they really are?
Yes, yeah, so it's a very complex issue. I mean, specifically in the context of Cabo, you saw that it mattered in that specific instance with the evictions, because the fact that the wrong owner was on the evictions is why they essentially got like a delay. Due to a technicality, those evictions were thrown out. The new owner had to refile. So they got that delay. So like in that specific instance, there's a very real benefit to understanding who your owner is and when ownership has changed, which, you know, these tenants aren't notified. They are not notified that the property went through foreclosure. They're not notified that it was sold. This is kind of information that you have to dig up. Specifically with Cabo San Lucas, the ownership structure they're using, it's not just through LLCs, but it's single property LLCs. So essentially each property is owned under a separate LLC. So if, you know, something goes horribly wrong at one property, basically that risk, that liability is isolated to that one property, and it can't kind of spread across that owner's portfolio. With that, when you're able to do that, you're able to isolate any kind of not just risk, but consequence, right? So like if you lose one property foreclosure, the lender can't go after any of the other properties. So the owner of Apple Sway lost before Cabo San Lucas four properties in spring to foreclosure. And then I think I saw an article just last week that they are now delinquent on loans for four more properties in Houston. So we have clearly this network of properties owned by the same owner who's clearly a problematic owner. There are conditions issues of their properties for years and years and years, but we don't really have any way to kind of connect all of these people together and understand that network of these bad owners, whether they be, in this case, it was just a very risky investment and the owner has been sued for that investment. If Apple Sway loses that one property, each property is owned under a separate LLC, they can continue to collect rent at those other properties while losing that one property. So after Cabo San Lucas, they still have a portfolio. They could still be perpetuating those same problems at those other properties, whether, you know, neglect, displacement through eviction. All of these properties could be occurring across the entire portfolio, but they're all owned under separate LLCs. And it becomes really hard to patch all of that together and understand kind of the larger pattern of behavior. And then in research, we see a lot specifically with out-of-state owners or particularly large owners. So like a large company that has, you know, hundreds or thousands of properties. We have seen a lot of research pointing to issues with those types of owners. So for example, high eviction rates, large institutional landlords have higher eviction rates, higher housing costs, more fees, increased disinvestment and disrepair. And then there's the issue, you know, there are some cases where if a landlord gets public funds, for example, with rental assistance, those funds are leaving the community. They're going with the landlord. And not just public funds, but I mean, the rent is going with the landlord. It might be going out of state. It's going elsewhere. So you have this situation where they could lose one property due to their problematic behavior, but nothing happens to those other properties. They can continue owning those properties and they can continue enabling mistreatment of tenants, whether it be neglect, disrepair, eviction, all these kinds of issues that I've been talking about. So this is not just an issue with large multifamily properties either. So as you know, I've mentioned all of the issues that tenants can face when they're in apartment complexes that are bought by these larger or out-of-state investor owners. This is also a huge issue with the purchase of single-family homes being converted to rental properties. So this is kind of the issue that gets the most attention on this, both in Texas and other places and really nationwide. But investor owners tend to target Black neighborhoods. They remove homes from the owner-occupied housing stock because they're buying those homes and converting them to rental. And those homes may have otherwise been a first-time home purchase by a Black or Brown family. Research has shown these purchases have negative impacts on neighborhoods. They decrease land value. They decrease the number of registered voters in a community. And they're targeting Black and Brown neighborhoods. So this becomes kind of a fair housing issue. This becomes a huge concern for those communities that are being targeted by these types of problematic owners.
So we see a lot of the sort of ways that these large investors can utilize LLCs to isolate bad acts to these individual LLCs to mitigate getting reprimanded or escape culpability for any issues that they may have, again, with condition or if a place is poorly run. But there are legitimate reasons to have an LLC. It isn't just like LLCs that are bad themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, an LLC is just a tool, right? It's just kind of it's a different kind of company or corporation. So LLCs, they pay lower taxes than a typical corporation. They have fewer reporting requirements. So that's what allows owners to keep their identity hidden. And it's easy to see how that could be misused, but there are legitimate uses. Like, for example, if you are somebody who has dealt with intimate partner violence and you want to keep your name out of public records, you can own a property through an LLC. And that's one way of kind of trying to stay safe. So there's definitely legitimate uses for LLCs. The problem isn't owning a property through an LLC. The problem is the behaviors that are associated with those certain types of owners that utilize the LLC structure. So like we're talking about out-of-state landlords, large landlords with a lot of properties. The LLC structure makes it harder to understand how to proactively address the issues associated with those landlords because we can't figure out who they are or what they own.
Let's go ahead and zoom out a little bit. Your work to dig deeper into finding out who these owners are and spread the idea around or inform just like a general audience that a lot of these owners are not known. They are unknown. So what is the value to the average renter to make them known, right? Like, how does this help a tenant in sort of letting them know that this exists? Because I mean, oftentimes I feel like if a tenant endeavors to improve a condition in their apartment or their complex, they might go through their lease. They look at the names on the leases and they maybe look them up and then they kind of find a dead end. So I guess how do tenants utilize this information that you are trying to uncover?
Yeah, there's no perfect answer to this. I mean, ultimately, you know, a tenant is going to deal with management day to day. Management's going to be the one that's working with tenants, filing these evictions, collecting rent, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, it's kind of an issue of a power imbalance, for one, that tenants deserve to know who owns their property and who's charging them rent and who's responsible for fixing their units. As far as, you know, any kind of like legal action goes, I mean, the owner would be the one who would be on the hook and be responsible. So if a tenant really wants to take any kind of action, you know, this is kind of a drastic measure, I suppose, you don't really see as often. But if a tenant wanted to take any kind of action against an owner, it would be the owner themselves. And usually they're just going to be dealing with lawyers. They're not going to be dealing with the owner. Largely, the kind of bigger issue to me as someone who focuses on data and research and statewide issues, the larger issue is that problem of these patterns that we can't address, that we need to address to help tenants. Legislators need to understand the scope of the issue in order to pass laws. Local governments need to understand the scope of the issue in order to put programs into place and kind of help address these patterns, because that's what they are. They are known patterns of behavior with these types of landlords. But we can't really identify those types of landlords, and we can't proactively work to prevent those known issues from occurring without having better data about what's going on and who really is the problem here.
In your research, when you were, I guess, tackling this before Cabo and Redford came into your view, what were you seeing other places, cities, states, what were you seeing them do to try to unmask these LLCs and be able to hold problem properties accountable?
Yes, I've seen largely kind of two types of policies that are used to address this issue. So the first is just looking at making that ownership data more available. So the number one program that's kind of the most common and used all over the place are rental registries, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a registry of rental properties, preferably with ownership data that is usable, downloadable, publicly available, and can be used to proactively inspect those properties that might exhibit signs of those patterns we were talking about and might have kind of problematic ownership that has run to that issue before. And because of the rental registry, we can connect those properties because we know who the owner is. So there are also, you know, some proactive inspection programs, like San Antonio has a proactive inspection program that is not associated with a rental registry. They use a database of code complaints at properties, which is great. I mean, that's still a good step forward towards trying to deal with at least some of the neglect and disrepair issues of these properties. But a rental registry, making that ownership information clear, is really valuable, you know, not just to advocates, not just to policymakers, but research. And then there's also federal work on this kind of thing. There's a New York LLC Transparency Act and then the 2021 U.S. Corporate Transparency Act. Those are two laws at New York and federal level that would make beneficial ownership information available to only government agencies and law enforcement. So it's not publicly available, but it's at least a sign that these are the kinds of things that the government is looking at. So other than making ownership data available, the other main method of trying to tackle this issue has been limiting the ability of these companies to purchase a large number of homes. The example that I use of this is the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act of 2023. It's not yet been passed, it's just been introduced, but it would prevent large companies from buying homes and enact tax penalties on owners with too many homes. So there's ways to both try to kind of clarify the issue, expose it, make it easier to look into, to research, to analyze, and then there's just kind of the actually trying to put a cap on it, to try to limit the number of properties that folks can buy. Although I would like to point out that that latter method of trying to control the number of properties, that tends to be focused on those single family housing issues, because that's where, as I said before, most of the attention has gone and where folks are really concerned because of the effect it might have on homeownership rates and folks' access to homeownership.
When you talked about the first method, it makes the information available to government agencies and law enforcement. If there were a lawsuit, do you think that that information could be obtained via legal request?
Oh boy, I believe so. This is where, you know, I'm going to say I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But, you know, once there is a court case, certain documents would be made public, certainly. I don't know in that specific law if that information would be able to become public. You can see that they're doing what they can to make it easier on themselves to investigate without really tackling the issue in a way that's kind of what I'm talking about, getting the public involved and getting them informed and aware of what's going on. It's understandable, but certainly not exactly what we would like to see considering how opaque this issue is.
Right. I mean, look, information like this, it seems as if, I mean, certainly it should be obtainable via legal challenge, but why not also obtainable via like a public information request? It feels like information that should be available. I mean, you can file a FOIA or you can file an information request for, I guess, the ownership of many things. So I think that open information generally, especially when it comes to ownership structures like this, can only serve a public good. But I guess that's just one person's opinion. I know you're on the research side of things. You know, you're not on the sort of policy side of things, but I would be really interested to hear from you. What do you think can be done here in Texas? Like what is something that you feel is replicable here for Texans and the tenants who live here?
Yeah. So, and I just want to highlight first too, that there has been, you know, some action on this at the statewide level in Texas. I mentioned in my blog that the single family investor home purchase issue certainly has been coming up. And in the last 2023 legislative session, there was SB 1979, which would have initiated a study, an annual study and report on single family home purchases by institutional buyers. And that law was vetoed by Greg Abbott during that legislative session. So unfortunately we won't see anything out of that, but there's obviously interest at the Texas legislature for looking into this kind of issue. And hopefully this next legislative session, they can kind of take some action without having that vetoed or shut down. But if this bill had passed, I mean, we would have had a better understanding of the scope of investor owners in the state. We could have passed better targeted legislation in the upcoming session to better protect renters and potential homebuyers. But ultimately, I would love to see the Texas legislature pass a bill similar to that End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act to limit individuals' ability to own an excessive number of properties. That would be incredible. I think the most realistic thing that we can see to address this issue is for individual cities to enact those meaningful rental registries with publicly available, usable data, not in PDF format, and to start those proactive inspection programs, which we've seen in a couple of Texas cities, but really should be backed up by that rental registry to make it, you know, a more publicly analyzable affair.
Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
You know, as you were talking about, you want this kind of stuff to be publicly available. I guess I want to stress this is a really hard topic to talk about in a way that is easy to understand. But like there is kind of data available. It's just easier to do in a one-off way, and it still is very hard. So like when I was checking Cabo ownership, first I went to the Harris County clerk to find the actual documents showing the foreclosure and sale. And then I went into, there's a website that I use called Open Corporates that kind of does those PIRs of that ownership information from states and compiles it together. But their data, like there aren't any newer reporting forms from this LLC beyond when they organized, when they created the LLC. So it just has, you know, the bridge lender I was talking about, like there are ways to get some information. It's very hard to patch it all together. It's not complete. And there's no expectation necessarily that it can be up to date and accurate. So it's difficult. I guess I just want to state that it is hard but possible to find out who owns a single property. It is nearly impossible to find out how many properties a person owns.
Well, I want to thank Sydney Beatty for joining us. Could you let our listeners know again how to find your work on LLCs?
Yeah, of course. You go to the Texas Housers blog, so texashousers.org. Look at our blog, and I think it's the second to last or third to last article on there is my blog post on LLC ownership in Texas.
I will put that information in the description of this episode, but for now, that'll do it for A Little Louder. JT Herrichmack will play us out, and until next time, bye for now. I don't wanna have a worry, I don't have a care. Haven't got a thing to call my own. Though I'm out of money, I'm a millionaire, 'cause I've still got my home.